Radio MD. RadioMD.com.
As a cardiologist and a chef, Dr. Michael Fenster has combined his culinary talents with cutting-edge medical expertise and insight. It's time for Code Delicious with Dr. Mike.
Hello, Food Nation, Healthy Nation. Are you ready for the scrumptious and the salubrious all wrapped up into one very tasty treat? I know that you are, and I know you know. That means it's time once again for another Code Delicious with Dr. Mike. I am Dr. Mike, and I am delighted to have back on the program today a good friend of the show, Professor Krishnan. He's a research microbiologist, been working with the gut microbiome for over 16 years. So he's one of the leaders in this very important field. And all of our regular listeners know I often talk about probiotics, the gut microbiome, its relationship to what we eat, health and disease, so forth. Professor Krishnan earned his Bachelor of Science in Microbiology at the University of Iowa and continued there for his postgraduate education in molecular biology and virology. They just completed really an incredible landmark study that was published just about a month or so ago. And we're going to talk about that and a whole lot more. So, Kieran, welcome to the show. Thanks for being back.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back.
And, you know, we're always getting new listeners, and certainly our regular listeners are well acquainted with the concept of probiotics, prebiotics, the gut microbiome. We talk about that a lot on the show because it's so very important in terms of our health, the quality of the food that we choose. But for some of our new listeners, could you just give them maybe a little kind of layman's introduction to that since we'll be talking about it on the show?
Sure, yeah, and probiotics in general. I mean, so a probiotic is really a beneficial bacteria that when administered at the right amount and assuming it can get into the gut and actually function can actually really dramatically alter health in a beneficial way. What we now understand about the amazing environment that exists between our mouth and our bottom in our digestive tract is that it controls virtually every aspect of our body, you know, our brain, our nerves, our hormones, virtually everything that we do has some influence from the microbes that live in our gut. So an effective probiotic, one that can actually make favorable changes in that environment, can be a major part of a truly healthy and wellness lifestyle.
And so we talked about, you know, maybe correcting a deficit, but I think one of the things that's a fascinating question to probe, forgive the pun, you know, from our aspect is this gut microbiome, these 100 trillion of bacteria, they've really co-evolved to co-metabolize our food with us, you know, really throughout the course of human evolution. And yet we're talking about a need now to potentially correct some deficits or abnormalities there. How does that happen? Where did we go wrong? Is it all bad genes? You know, how do we screw up the microbiome?
Yeah, and that's the most important question in all of this is what are we doing and what did we do to screw up the microbiome? One of the things that we know is that our microbiome really is an ecology. You know, we're like a walking, talking rainforest. We're really made up of thousands of different species that coexist and work together and communicate together to better the overall health of the entire collective. Now, where we're going wrong is we're doing things to either selectively destroy certain aspects of that population or things that just get in there and really perturb the population. For example, you know, if you had a garden, if you liken your probiotic to a garden outside, if you had a garden, a beautiful lush garden with 1,000 different plants, if you're hitting that garden with, you know, chemicals every day and poisons essentially that kill off certain groups of plants, you kind of cause an ecological issue within that garden. And that's basically what we're doing. I mean, when we look at preservatives in our food, when we look at things like the weed killers, you know, glyphosate, we now know that that has a significant impact on the microbiome. We know that overuse of antibiotics, both, of course, clinically and then also in the food system. You know, we know that fluoride in drinking water, chlorine in drinking water, all of these things that are facets of the modern world seem to be having a very negative impact on our inner garden, if you will.
And what's very important, and you kind of alluded to that, is that it's sort of not just a garden that we go out and tend, or we just grow flowers for show, as it were, but really it interacts with us in a very constant and powerful way. So one could say, you know, this is a garden that is not just ornamental, but it, in essence, if we were to use that analogy, it'd be our garden that we require to live. It would be giving us the food that we need to live. And so if we're missing certain things there, is that one of the causes that we see associated with this modern Western diet with all the additives and things you said, where we're seeing sort of this chronic inflammatory root causing diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, autoimmune disease, the neurodegenerative diseases. Is there a link there between, what we experience in our garden?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was really the crux of the study that we published in August of this year, is showing the extremely important protective function that a healthy gut microbiome or a healthy gut flora plays in protecting the host from the process of eating, digesting food, trying to assimilate those nutrients. One of the things that we see as a process of eating is a generation of all of these endotoxins. They're called LPS, lipopolysaccharides. And these endotoxins, if we don't have a healthy microbiome that's basically neutralizing them, that's creating a very important barrier between the digestive system and our blood system, metabolizing certain things that can actually be detrimental to our gut lining, if they're not doing those functions, then these endotoxins end up leaking in and essentially entering our blood system. So what we were able to do was take healthy young college students, you know, these are people in the prime of their lives, no obesity, no Frank disease at all, no complaints of any sort. So the healthiest of what we consider the healthy population. And we were able to give them a challenge meal. So we bring them into the lab in the morning and we in a fasted state, and we give them a high caloric, high fat meal. And then we measure the presence of this toxin in their blood. And when they come in at a fasted state, there's a very, very low basal level of this toxin. And we know that this toxin is generated in the digestive tract. And then after 5 hours after eating the meal, we see almost a 600% increase in this toxin in the blood. We can directly measure it in the blood. Now, along with that, about 18 different inflammatory markers go up as well. You know, and in previous studies that the university had done on this model, they showed that it takes the body 2 weeks to recover from that single insult, from the inflammatory process that occurs after that meal, right? So we never recover from it. So the protection against this effect, well, the fancy term for it is metabolic endotoxemia, but the protection against this toxicity after eating is 100% dependent on these microbes. You know, so they are producing metabolites, they are creating barriers and things like that to protect the host, and without them, eating becomes the most toxic thing we can do.
Well, you know, I've always said disease is kind of an interplay between our environment and our genetics, and there's no more powerful environmental exposure short of environmental catastrophe. You know, if you're vacationing, you know, you got a beach house at Fukushima, you know, outside of that, the most important environmental impact is what we take outside in our food and put inside in our body every day. And I noticed you were crafty in the study. You lured those college kids in with some pizza. Which is what you're better.
Exactly.
You hit them where they couldn't resist.
They figured, you know, that we'll pay them a little bit of money and come in and eat pizza. Hey, we were getting droves of college kids hitting the lab.
I know that's a one way to, you know, easily do a 30,000, you know, person studies offer, you know, we'll pay you to eat pizza and you got the college kids signing up. But, you know, on a serious note, I wanted to ask you if you could tell for our listeners, you talked about this endotoxemia. So folks are eating and then they had this sort of toxic response to that. Is any of that normal, or is that toxic response, you know, a completely abnormal phenomenon in a healthy person?
So that was what was surprising to us. You know, we had to screen about 100 college students to get a real understanding of what the prevalence rate of this toxic phenomenon is in a healthy population, and we found that it was about 50%. So 50% of the healthy, young, normal people, every time they ate, they had this huge toxic response. Based on other research that's available, it looks like when you look at older populations, people in their 30s, 40s, and beyond, especially if they already have some form of chronic disease, whether it's, you know, allergies or type 2 diabetes or, you know, precursors for heart disease, the likelihood of them having this toxic phenomenon is much higher. It's probably 80 and 90%. And the reason for that is because the effect of this toxicity, the incoming LPS into the system, and then the type of immune activation that it starts up is the same type of risk factors. It's the exact risk factors that start heart disease, that start diabetes, that start even as of September 4th, a paper published that showed that this toxin that comes from the gut is the primary driver of plaque formation in Alzheimer's. So it can
So we're linking the neurodegenerative, the obesity, which animal models have shown is really a transmissible inflammatory type of disease, not simply, you know, going out and grazing too long at the salad bar, cardiovascular disease, diabetes. They're all kind of rooted in, or at least potentially correlated to origins from the gut. Am I hearing that correctly?
Absolutely, yeah. This toxicity, this endotoxemia that occurs from the process of eating on a daily basis, if you don't have a healthy flora and microbiome to protect you against the process of eating and digestion, then you end up with these toxins in your system, and the type of immune activation that results is exactly the immune activation that starts off most chronic diseases that we're dealing with. And I always say to people that if this endotoxemia is not the cause of your chronic condition, it is at least playing a significant role in perpetuating that condition. You know, so you may have other causes that's causing your condition, but it's at least perpetuating and making it very difficult to treat your condition.
Right. So there's definitely some sort of link, even though we may not have all the details. We can start to see some of these pieces coming into play, maybe, you know, a bigger picture, and kind of goes back to, you know, what I was told is the way to somebody's heart, particularly heart disease, I guess really could be right through their stomach.
This is really
fascinating. So I've got to ask. So we found this causal link really in what we would consider asymptomatic folks.
Yep.
Was there any intervention that could be done when you observed this that helped them or potentially reversed it?
Yeah, and so that was the most exciting part, that once we found the responders who had this toxic response to eating food, we put them in the study, and then we put them, they were randomized either into a placebo group or the spore-based probiotic group. So these are really unique bacterial strains that are called Bacillus endospores. In previous studies on animal models, they've been showing that these spores seem to have a regulatory or protective function in the gut. Basically, what they do is they can get in and they can change the flora to make it a more favorable flora that helps protect the body through the process of digestion, and also it increases the digestibility of the food itself. So we presume that, okay, if we can get these probiotics into these individuals, maybe we can see a change in this toxic response. And in fact, the data became even stronger than we expected, because when we put them on this probiotic for 30 days and then they came back and we did the same challenge, we saw a 45% reduction in the toxic response to food in just 30 days. You know, and that's with no other changes to their diet, lifestyle, knowing that these are college kids, they're not doing anything good for the health of their system in those 30 days, right? You know, and we weren't sure about that, right? We thought, oh my God, things are going to get worse. How do we know that just doing the probiotic alone is going to make that improvement? But it did. And here was the scary part. In the placebo group, the group that ended up getting the placebo, not only was there no reduction in the toxicity, but there was a 32% increase in toxicity the second time we did the test. You know, so they're getting worse. That condition is getting worse and worse. And even in just 30 days, we could see that. You know, and so the changes were phenomenal. And then, of course, there were all of these other biological changes that were quite amazing as well.
And, you know, and I'm going to get a little technical here, and I'm going to give the audience a little background. One of the fascinating pieces for me that I saw was that one of the things that you measured that was statistically significantly reduced after the probiotic intervention was an instigator of the inflammatory response, something called interleukin 1 beta. And did I recall that correctly? Was that something that you were able to measure and saw a positive decrease once the folks were on the probiotic therapy?
Yeah, absolutely. That one, and then there's a couple of cousins to that. There's interleukin 6 and then MCP1. And what those three things, especially together, tell us is that we're reducing inflammation not only systemically but also at the gut lining. That MCP1 is interesting because it typically indicates that immune cells, pro-inflammatory immune cells, are being recruited to the gut lining to deal with the food that's coming in, which means that you every time you eat, it's causing a massive inflammatory response in the lining, which then opens up the gut lining, and then all of these toxins leak through into your circulation. So we saw interleukin 1, like you mentioned, interleukin 6, MCP1, all of these things go down in a statistically significant manner, showing a huge change in the inflammatory response to the food in just 30 days. You know, so that was fascinating.
And where I draw this correlation and is that just earlier, about a month ago in early September, at the European Cardiology meeting, they released the results of a trial which was called CANTOS. And where this was fascinating to me is that, you know, believe it or not, you know, there's still a lot of resistance in I could speak to cardiology, for example, that, you know, it's inflammation that is responsible for the development of atherosclerosis and cardiovascular disease. A lot of folks say, well, you know, it's just the cholesterol, cut the cholesterol down, everything will get better. Statins work, they reduce cholesterol, but they also reduce inflammation. So this trial used an extremely expensive monoclonal antibody to shut down the IL-1 beta production. And yet here you are achieving this with something that's got to be a fraction of the cost.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fraction of the cost, and it's doing it in a natural way because the IL-1 beta production is not being triggered by the presence of food, right? So we are we're not intervening in the immune system's ability to respond to things. What we're doing is modulating the reason to respond. You know, the immune system is saying, now, hey, this food is not a problem anymore, and it's not, the food particles aren't actually getting into the parts of the intestinal linings that would create a response. And so we're basically protecting the immune cells from having to deal with the food. And so we're not, you know, in any way disrupting the function of the immune system. They don't have to function. You know, they don't have to attack the food. And that was significant. Now, another significant part of it was this, ghrelin. You know, ghrelin being the hunger hormone, it was really interesting for me to see that in the placebo group, they would come in a fasted state, so their hunger hormone levels would be quite high, as you would expect. But then we give them this 2,000-calorie meal, and the hunger hormone levels stay relatively high, especially compared to the fasted state, you know, which means that there's no communication between the gut and the brain, where the gut is telling the brain, hey, we have enough food coming in, let's shut off these hunger hormones. And in the probiotic treatment group, we saw a statistically significant drop in ghrelin after eating the meal, which means we're starting to restore that communication between the gut and the brain, where the gut can tell the brain, hey, this is plenty of calories, shut off the hunger hormone. You know, and so
that's really incredible.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've got to ask, you know, we saw this with a positive intervention, but it's an intervention, you know, unlike the monoclonal antibody, which is sort of targeting the effect, you're really focused on, if I'm kind of getting the gist of this right, and restoring the natural balance, the natural order of things, if you will.
Exactly.
And so I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit, if you'd be willing. I wonder, what are your thoughts on the effect if we got people on this probiotic regimen for 30 days, but in that same 30 days, we weren't giving them that pizza, which probably has a bunch of additives, high fructose corn syrup and the pizza sauce, you know, all this processed refined flour, etc., cheese with preservatives. But we put them on something in which they were really choosing quality, natural foods. What do you think we'd see?
So during the 30 days, you mean they're eating healthy food?
Well, you know, you could have pizza, but let's say instead of a pizza where we have the pizza sauce, you know, you buy it from as a chef that you can buy it and you can buy it in your supermarket. It's loaded with sugar, high fructose corn syrup, preservatives. Yeah. These are the, you know, part skim mozzarella. So they're modified. They've got additives and stabilizers, things that we know like polysorbate 80, you know, can negatively affect that gut microbiome. The highly refined, you know, white flours is what they're using to make these pizza crust. Say I was going to give them a pizza made with just tomatoes and a tomato sauce and herbs, olive oil, natural buffalo mozzarella, you know, a fine ancient grain, Durum semolina, you know, double O pizza crust. You know, basically I'd send them to Naples and get some real food.
Exactly. The way pizza should be. Yeah. You know, and that's an important question because one of the things we saw is that, you know, once your gut is dysbiotic, meaning the flora is imbalanced, there's you don't have the proper diversity and the function within the microbiome to protect ourselves from the eating process. Even when you eat healthy food, you do still get some rise in the endotoxemia. However, it is measurably lower. So we find that when we use processed, really high calorically dense and high fat foods, especially things done with poor fats, like, you know, vegetable oils are used for deep frying and all that, we find that the response is 6x what their baseline is. So six times higher. Now, if we take somebody that has a disturbed gut, which is, I think, seemingly the vast majority of people walking around, and we give them a really healthy meal, they might get a 2 or 3x, but they're still getting some response. And so it seems critical that not only changing the diet becomes an absolutely important part of that healthy lifestyle and reducing this toxic response, but you do have to go in and get that gut fixed as well.
And you talked about some of the things that you guys checked and you measured. And I'm wondering, is this something that is just in the research arena right now? Or could our listeners go to their family doc or a GI specialist and say, hey, I want this test. I want to see if I'm one of these people that respond poorly, you know, to my typical diet. So what's the status of that? And do you see that if it's not currently available, is that potentially a screening mechanism?
Yeah, in fact, we've started doing that already. We've started working with clinicians and having their patients do this type of test. So basically, the most of the markers that we use are all readily available at LabCorp and Quest and all of these big labs. It's basically testing for LPS and LBP. And then, of course, all those interleukins, the ones you mentioned, the interleukin 1, interleukin 6, all of these cytokines are all available in standard panels, chemistry panels that or immune panels that the doctor can order. The key would be to really do it like the way we did in the study. They should go into their doctor and talk to the doctor about getting a blood draw in a fasted state with all of these things like LPS, LBP, and the full immune panel. And then they should eat a you know, fast food meal and then come back 3 to 5 hours later and get a second blood draw done and then compare the two. If you see a significant increase in all of these inflammatory markers and then in LPS, LPS is a toxin we actually measured, then they know that, hey, these things are all leaking in from my digestive tract going right into my circulatory system. You know, so they can absolutely mimic what we did in the study working with their doctors.
Well, that would be great because we have folks come in all the time. You know, we want a fasting lipid profile if they're a little bit askew. So they're coming in a fasting state anyway and to sort of challenge them and then have this. I just think that would give a tremendous amount because you're not just sort of measuring a random level. You're actually looking at a physiologic response that has, you know, some prognostic a value. And so I'm going to ask you to prognosticate a little further. So where do you see this going? Because it seems to me, this is, you know, something I'm really fascinated with. The folks know, you know, I've written my books on it. My new book coming out, deals again with the gut microbiome, and how some other things, the softer edges of the food experience, can, you know, affect our gut microbiome and our being. But where do you see this going in the future? If you could gaze into your crystal ball.
You know, I would think that this type of finding, this metabolic endotoxemia, this toxicity associated with eating, is going to become a base level test that we do in clinic to figure out what is the driver of the condition that people are suffering from. We know that, you know, if someone comes in, for example, with autoimmune disease or heart disease or diabetes or even dealing with obesity, we know that, you know, they have all of these other interventions that they can do. But if this endotoxic response is happening every time they eat, in their other therapies, what they're essentially doing is taking one step forward, two steps back. You know, we can't really ever make that progress if we don't turn off this inflammatory tap. And so I think it has to become a basic part.
And you're hitting the first rule of medicine, right? Which is, yeah, Let's stop the bleeding. I mean, exactly. We're putting Band-Aids on and we're not stopping the bleeding at all. Hey, Kieran, before we wrap up, can you let folks know where they can get more information on you and the stuff and the work and the products that you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my partner companies have put up a lot of information there. They go to Thrive Probiotic. That's www.thriveprobiotic.com. They can find a lot of stuff on this research, webinars, videos, all of that stuff, so they can learn more about all of this.
Hey, Kieran, thanks so much for being here today. Always a pleasure. Can't wait to have you back on. We'll talk more about this research. Folks, make sure you head over to www.chefdrmike.com and get your newsletter so you're up to date. It'll be emailed in your inbox before every Code Delicious program. And until we meet again, may the only pain in your life be champagne.